Dr. Paul here. Welcome to With the Wind, Science Revealed. My guest today is Dr. Ken Stoller. He's the author of a book, Incurable Me. In fact, he's got a new revised version coming out, Incurable Us. This is a masterpiece on virtually any chronic disease you might be facing. You've got to get this book. Now, we cover his journey from being a board-certified pediatrician into functional medicine. He's a hyperbaric oxygen expert, and we talk about what's happened in the field of medicine and what's happening in our world today. Didi closes it out with her usual interesting questions, probing into a little bit of his personal life. Enjoy the show. Dr. Paul, coming to you from the heart. I want to just chat with you about maybe living a spiritual life in these times we're finding ourselves in. I'm troubled with what I hear in the news about what's going on in the world. I mean, what's going on in Israel and Gaza, the harm that's coming to innocent people on all sides of conflict. This is something that just is hard to know what to do with in a spiritual sense. And I feel it's time to really pray. Can we as a people seek that higher power, seek that love, and ask for that intervention into the lives of our entire world? Because I don't think alone anybody can fix this. But united and together in a spiritual, powerful place, change can happen, and I believe change will happen. So thank you for joining me, all of you who can, in reaching out for peace, in a prayerful call to the Almighty, to love, to bring us peace. Welcome, Dr. Ken Stoller, to With the Wind, Science Revealed. I have been remiss in not getting you on this show for a very long time. Thank you for being with us.
You're welcome.
And we have a lot in common, but you were way ahead of me on figuring a lot of things out. So you're now retired from clinical practice. You were a board-certified pediatrician, and now you're in functional medicine. You did a lot of work with hyperbaric oxygen treatments. You're an author. I just went through your book. I would have it right here where Vaxxed Unvaxxed is shown, but behind me, but I got the e-version. There it is. Yep. So I read it online because I didn't get it in time. I should have read that book the moment you wrote it. It is way ahead of its time. And we'll get into some of the stuff that's in that book. Incurableme.org is where people can go and find you, correct?
Correct.
All right. And I like what you wrote. I read somewhere you're writing saying that you're working to close the divide between quality healthcare and the complex trio of pharmaceutical companies, insurance agencies, and government influence. Yeah. Wow. Just for fun, let's start with your childhood and what led you to get into medicine to begin with.
I don't know if it's true or not, but this is the story I tell. I was temporarily paralyzed from the waist down 2 weeks after receiving a polio vaccine when I was 4 years old. Of course, I didn't know what had happened at the time. I didn't know for decades what had happened. But I knew that if I got involved in medicine, one day I would figure out, I'd ask the right person. And it never happened. It didn't matter how many pediatric neurologists I asked or pediatricians. They had no idea what had happened to me. And that speaks to the fact that vaccines are a sacred cow, and you don't even put them on the table as a potential cause of any untoward reactions.
Yeah. How long, do you recall how long you had paralysis?
My guess, it was only 45 minutes, but I was four. So I was at the little girl across the street's birthday party, and I was not feeling well. I was having a prodrome of nausea and queasiness and lightheadedness. And I sat down on a lounge chair, and instantly I could not move my lower extremities. And I was taken to the scene of the crime, which was my pediatrician's office. But even as I was being taken there, I could start to feel like I was moving my legs again. And by the time the pediatrician came in, I couldn't tell anything had happened.
Interesting.
So it was a really short, have you ever heard of something like that before, where it's just instantaneous paralysis and then 40 minutes later, you're fine? It was a very weird experience. But I was at dinner with my mom and some friends, and this man developed polio when he was a UCLA student. And I asked him how the prodrome, what happened? Were you feeling sick? Did the paralysis come on gradually? Was it all at once? And when he was done describing to me what had happened to him, I went, that's exactly what happened to me. And then I turned to my mom and I said, did I get the polio vaccine anywhere near that little girl's birthday party? And she said, yeah, 2 weeks before.
Interesting. So you've probably, while we're on polio, just for fun, you've probably done a deep dive into polio. And what do you think of the narrative that it was the vaccine that got rid of polio?
The polio virus, it's an enterovirus, and there are many enteroviruses, and some are probably more dangerous than others, if there's a toxic cofactor. And what I mean by that is it really needs to have your immune system compromised. And one of the best ways to compromise your immune system is with pesticides. This group of viruses, these enteroviruses that have been with us for eons, never caused
any hundreds of years.
Millions, probably.
Yeah.
It never caused anything but maybe diarrhea and an upset stomach, until pesticides showed up. So the first cases of paralysis were taking place in the areas that were most heavily using lead arsenate pesticides. So this was in the late 1800s. And then DDT ended up replacing lead arsenate. And it got to the point where the government was recommending that DDT be sprayed on everything and everywhere. And they actually thought it was going to help, or somebody did, maybe, the polio epidemic. But it actually was making the polio epidemic worse, because the DDT destroyed people's immune system. So this virus that normally might just cause you diarrhea was now getting into your central nervous system and causing paralysis. So the countries that use the most DDT and make the most DDT have the most cases of paralysis. Now, what Burkitt's lymphoma is, it's a cancer of the salivary glands that you find in kids in Africa. And we were taught, oh, it's a combination of Epstein-Barr virus and malaria, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
No, it's a combination of Epstein-Barr virus and DDT. So they've done studies showing that if you're exposed to Epstein-Barr virus, your chance of lymphoma does not increase. If you're exposed to PCBs, which is an organochlorine, just like DDT is, your chances of lymphoma are not increased. But if you have exposure to both the Epstein-Barr virus and DDT, now your chances of getting lymphoma go up 20 times.
Yeah.
It's the synergy between the toxic cofactor destroying your immune system and the virus causes a lot of these problems.
Yeah.
But we can't blame DDT. Because that would have put, never mind Big Cam and their influence, it would have created tremendous liability for the government, because not only did they encourage it, but they were spraying it everywhere.
Yeah. So just to jump back to your childhood polio, and then what in your lifetime besides that, if anything, prepared you or motivated you to get into medicine?
So I think that my paralysis incident with the polio vaccine was a subconscious driver of, I didn't necessarily connect the dots that, oh, this is where I wanted to go into medicine so I could get the answer to this. But I think that was part of it. And it was just encouraged in my family. So
yeah,
I went with the flow. I get along, go along to get along.
And why pediatrics?
Oh, that was a process of elimination. All the other specialties seem to have way too many problems connected with them. And I thought in pediatrics, most of your patients do their best to get well. They're full of vim and vim, vigor and youth, and they help you help them get better. Where that's not the case when you're in geriatric medicine. And I think given my druthers, I would have gone into OBGYN, but when I was getting trained, all they were doing is teaching residents how to do C-sections.
Yep.
They weren't teaching residents how to help women with difficult labor. And so I thought it was a little on the barbaric side and didn't want to go into it because of that.
Yeah. So you did something quite remarkable and were almost two decades ahead of me on this one. You actually resigned from the American Academy of Pediatrics. But prior to that, my guess is you had this growing awareness that the childhood vaccine schedule was part of the problem. Can you walk me through your kind of medical school? We're just taught vaccines are safe and effective, and this is what you do, right? They didn't really teach us much.
I don't even think they said safe and effective. They just said, this is when you give them. It's not something you questioned. You didn't question the vaccines.
So when did you start questioning them? What was your sort of progression along waking up to the problem?
So this was like 1989, early 1990. And I mistakenly thought that I needed to obtain informed consent from parents for this new hepatitis B vaccine. I didn't know anything about this new hepatitis B vaccine. And so since it was a new vaccine, I said, I need to know, did I do that for the other vaccines? No, you just accepted them. This is what you do. But here's this new vaccine. And what I wanted, what was curious to me was, how did they get approval to do studies to show that this was effective for one-day-old infants? Because that's what they were recommending. You give the hepatitis B vaccine to one-day-old infants. And I spent about 3 months on and off trying to find something in the medical literature that would provide rationale for giving hepatitis B vaccine to a one-day-old infant whose mother did not have hepatitis B. Now, right. How many mothers in the United States every year have chronic active hepatitis B? About 200.
In the whole country.
In the whole country.
Yeah.
Here's a vaccine that might, if it works, assuming it works, might be useful to an infant whose mother has chronic active hepatitis B, but absolutely has no benefit to an infant whose mother does not have hepatitis B, but here we are giving it to everybody. And so after 3 months of trying to find something in the medical literature as to why this was a good idea, the little devil that sits on your shoulder said, you think you're such a good researcher, you can't find anything. You're not a good researcher. And then the little angel says, maybe the reason you can't find anything is because there's nothing to find. And I went, oh my God, this is a scam. The whole hepatitis B vaccine thing's a scam.
Yep.
And I went, if this is a scam, are the other vaccines that I've been blindly giving also a scam? And so I started researching the other vaccines. Now, at the same time, I saw the first autistic child come into my... I had never seen autism, ever. In my residency, in medical school, nothing. And I was going to myself silently, please don't be here for autism. I don't know how to treat autism. Please don't be here for autism. My nurse, who could read my mind, I didn't know how lucky I was. She said, yeah, that kid's not here for autism. He's here for worms. Oh, worms? I can do worms. Okay. I prescribed the child mebendazole, which at that time was called Vermox.
Yep.
And I got a call from the mom later that afternoon. What did you give my kid? He's making better eye contact. He's more social. He's calmer. And he's more verbal. And I went, Jesus, I don't know. So I ended up calling the Janssen Pharmaceuticals, which was making the mebendazole at that time. And I asked, how does this stuff work? And the scientist at Janssen said, It works by blocking molecules of a certain molecular weight from crossing over cellular membranes. So in the case of the hapless worm, it blocks the sugar moieties and the worm starves to death because that's how they absorb their nutrients through their bodies. And I said, would it also block molecules of a certain molecular weight from crossing over the cells in the intestinal villi? And she said, yes. Okay, scratch. So this kid either has something in his gut that shouldn't be in his gut that's affecting his brain, or he has something in his gut that everybody has in his gut, but for some reason, it's affecting his brain. Now, at the time, so this was how many years ago? 10, 20, 30. So this is like 30, closing in on 34, 35 years. The only organization in Southern California, because I had my pediatric practice in beautiful downtown Burbank, was CAN, Cure Autism Now. And they said, well, we'll put you in touch with the researcher who's studying secretin, which didn't pan out, by the way. And I talked to the researcher. He said, when we're done with secretin, maybe we'll check this out. I didn't have an autistic child. I didn't have a lot of pressure to figure out what was going on other than to note this interesting event. And it took years for me to figure out that what I was doing was blocking gluten or gluten fragments from getting into this child's bloodstream. And I go, well, there goes my Nobel Prize, because if gluten's the problem, the answer is to stop eating gluten, not take a chemical that blocks its absorption. That's how I got both into the vaccine vigilant mode. And it's also how I got into treating autistic kids, because I knew, because for me, that was saying, this is not some kind of psychiatric disorder. This is a medical problem that has potential interventions, including going on a gluten-free diet. So that's how I started getting into treating autistic kids.
Wow. And that was 30 years ago or longer.
Yeah. And I didn't stop giving vaccines right away. What happened was, because I was learning so much about the vaccine program and all these other vaccines, most of which are scams, and we can get into that if you want, but I was giving longer and longer informed consent lectures. So I was basically for 40 minutes obtaining informed consent, which I, as I said, I didn't know I didn't have to do anymore, because the 1986 Vaccine Act relieved pediatricians of having to obtain informed consent for vaccines.
I think I know the answer, but why do you say that?
That's my understanding of the law. It was not required anymore to get informed consent to give vaccines.
Yeah, and there's certainly, it took away all liability. So you could do whatever you wanted and it wouldn't matter.
But I didn't know that. So my informed consent speeches were getting longer and longer. And no one, after spending 40 minutes of uncompensated time, wanted vaccines after I gave the true pros and cons. And so
that's been my experience too.
And so I stopped giving them. So that's how it started.
So what year was that roughly when you stopped giving them?
I would say I stopped giving them completely in 1997.
Wow, you were way ahead of our times. So how long after that did you continue to practice pediatrics?
I continued to practice pediatrics along with hyperbaric medicine probably through in 2012.
Wow, almost 12, 15 years of pediatrics without vaccinating. Reflect back for me the decade that you were a pediatrician vaccinating according to what you thought was right, which we were taught to do. And then those 12, 15 years after, when you were no longer vaccinating, what did you find a difference in the health outcomes of your population?
I was a new pediatrician, We're pretty much the same age. I might be a couple of years older than you. But what I was a new pediatrician, and then I didn't understand why I was seeing so many ear infections. I didn't understand why I was seeing so much eczema. I didn't understand why I was seeing so much asthma. And I went, is this new? I don't think this is a new phenomenon. I don't remember when I was a kid, every other kid having an ear infection or bad asthma. And when you go, there's something in the environment, but what? And I even had kids come to me with what I'm calling subclinical Pink's disease. So Pink's disease is a disorder where the skin sloughs off the hands and the new skin's very pink. And it's called Pink's disease. And it occurred at a time when we were giving babies teething powders that had mercury in them. And the body has a dysfunctional way of trying to get rid of heavy metals. And one of the ways it does that is it causes the skin to peel on your hands and your feet. But it wasn't so bad that it was Pink disease, but I had so many parents saying, why is the skin peeling on my kids' palms? And all I could say at the time was, their body doesn't like something and it's trying to get rid of it, but I didn't know really what it was that they're trying to get rid of. And despite all the research I had done on vaccines, I really didn't look at them in terms of what's in them. What are the ingredients? I was just looking at them. Do they work? Is there good clinical evidence that they work? Not about what are they made out of? So it took a little longer for me to figure out. I'm looking at mercury poisoning. Now, eventually, and you remember what that study that came out around 2000 showing that the hepatitis B vaccine in Canada, because originally the hepatitis B vaccine did have thimerosal, the mercury preservative. It's not the mercury. Thimerosal is not a preservative. It's an adjuvant, but they said it was a preservative. So they, because if something's an adjuvant, you have to, I thought, test it to make sure it's safe. Okay. But apparently they didn't have that problem when, because as they were phasing out mercury, they were adding in aluminum. And I don't, these people have rules. They don't follow their rules. For example, the 1986 Vaccine Act required HHS every 2 years to report to Congress about how they're improving the safety of vaccines.
And they never did.
Never made one report. So they were violating the law to their benefit. So there were no reports on vaccine safety, and they don't care about vaccine safety. Now, that act, the 1986 Vaccine Act, removed safety issues from under the mantle of the manufacturers. And HHS itself was now responsible for safety, which they completely ignored.
So nobody's paying any attention whatsoever.
No, and if you look at the early 1980s, and this was actually right before the 1986 Vaccine Act, the FDA went on record stating what their policy is. Safety issues, no matter how well-founded, are not to interfere with national vaccine policy.
It's all about the program.
It's about the program, not about whether they're harming anybody or whether the vaccines work. It's about protecting the program.
Yep. And boy, have they done that on steroids now. You and I being examples, just let's pivot briefly. What's happened to your career and your license, and does it have anything to do with your speaking the truth?
No, I've always spoke the truth. And I think I got a target on my back when I came out heavily against the HPV vaccine. And there was a documentary that was being filmed, and I was the first one to be interviewed for it. And
was that for the greater good?
No, the greater good had already come out. This was another one, and Merck found out about it and saw the footage and obviously would have seen me. They ended up paying off the two guys who were doing this documentary. So the whole documentary vanished. But I think I got on the radar of these pharmaceutical companies. And also I would be going to Board of Pharmacy meetings and pointing out that the way the vaccines are made, the way they're tested, violated the Drug Act in New Mexico, where I was practicing at the time. But nobody cares. If the CDC approved it, that's good enough for them.
I actually want to go back to the question I asked you because you didn't quite answer it, which was, how did you see the health of your population in pediatrics once you stopped vaccinating? You had over 10 years of new babies coming into your practice. You're watching their growth and development. They have less chronic disease?
When I started my solo private pediatric practice, daycare was just coming out on the scene. And those kids would be in my office every 2 weeks.
With the daycare kids?
The daycare kids. So it was really good for business. But what I did was I had them, the moms, give the kids a teaspoon of 10 parts per million colloidal silver first thing in the morning and first thing when they got back from daycare. And it's not exactly the answer to your question. They stopped coming in. They weren't getting sick every 2 weeks. They would still get the viruses, whatever the virus du jour was for that week, but they wouldn't get the secondary infections that, you know, really made them sick. So colloidal silver really improved the quality of health of these kids that were, especially the ones getting exposed to every virus that was coming down the pipe. I didn't notice that. I was just happy that people weren't getting sick. I didn't notice, the unvaccinated kids are healthier the way you did than the vaccinated.
How about the big things you would have noticed? Autism, severe asthma, diabetes, type 1 insulin-dependent diabetes. Did you see any of that in your unvaxxed population?
The answer to that is no. But again, I didn't make the connections completely the way you did, that the vaccines were not only didn't work and were causing problems, but were making all these, were driving the ear infections, were driving the eczema, were driving the asthma.
Yeah.
It was a process for me. Now, again, I started my process much earlier than other physicians, but it was still a process for me.
Yeah. No, I think it is for most of us. It took me a long time to figure it out. So you at some point there pivoted into working in the hyperbaric oxygen realm. Explain that a little bit.
So hyperbaric oxygen is providing oxygen under pressure. And we use the same kind of chambers that scuba divers get treated for decompression with. And it was 1995. And one of my friends, who was the head of Apple Computer's Advanced Technology Group, was found dead in bed by his wife, revived by paramedics, was in a coma for 2 weeks. And when I visited him in the hospital, I was surprised that the treatment he was getting was an IV drip. And I go, we don't have anything for a brain injury caused by lack of oxygen other than an IV drip. So that's when I found out about hyperbaric oxygen therapy. And to make a long story short, when I found out you could treat kids with cerebral palsy, I was sold. And I opened up my first center in Santa Fe in 2001. And my first patient was a cerebral palsy patient. And she went in the chamber with her grandmother. And when they were done with their treatment, the grandmother says, I have fibromyalgia and my symptoms are gone.
Wow.
So that's when I learned, hey, this can treat fibromyalgia, which is obviously a mitochondrial dysfunction, because that's how hyperbaric oxygen works. It works by rehabilitating and reviving mitochondrial function. And if everyone remembers high school biology, mitochondria are the energy centers of our cells. They convert oxygen and sugar into the gasoline the cells run on. So it's all about energy. And if you don't have energy, in your cells, they're either idling, which what happens with brain injuries, or you're having metabolic problems. Now, hyperbaric oxygen activates thousands of genes, so it's not just the mitochondria that it works on, but I could not stop treating with hyperbaric oxygen therapy because I could see what it was doing for people, how it was returning functionality to their lives. And I was treating things that had no treatments, stroke patients, traumatic brain injuries, cerebral palsy, post-polio syndrome, multiple sclerosis, Lyme disease. The list was getting longer and longer. And it's not magic, but I considered it near magic. And I never looked back after starting to treat patients with hyperbaric oxygen therapy.
Wow. So with this sort of world we live in with growing lists of chronic conditions, sounds like hyperbaric oxygen ought to be something most people have access to.
Yeah, absolutely. And now let me give you an example. In 2005, I published a paper in the most prestigious pediatric journal in the United States, Pediatrics, it's called. And my paper was on treating fetal alcohol syndrome with hyperbaric oxygen therapy. Now, I really wanted to write a paper about cerebral palsy, but there were so many people gunning for hyperbaric oxygen and cerebral palsy because other specialties were making money on cerebral palsy. The baclofen pumps that the orthopedists would install, the splints that the kids need, it's a business treating kids with cerebral palsy. So if you come along and say you can cure cerebral palsy or vastly improve it clinically, you're stepping on other people's financial toes. There was no one interested in fetal alcohol syndrome. Even today, if you go to the CDC website, it's not treatable, it's not curable. So I published this paper in 2005. It took 15 years for another group to duplicate my findings. And this was the Israeli group out of Tel Aviv. And they did me one better. They did brain scans. I was only doing neurocognitive tests, but they did brain scans as well. And they're saying this is the cure for fetal alcohol syndrome. And I thought when this paper got published, people would be knocking down my door. Fetal alcohol syndrome is supposedly the most common non-hereditary cause of mental retardation. Now, you and I know that's not true. The most common cause of non-hereditary mental retardation is the vaccines. The vaccines are destroying the kids' brains. Fetal alcohol syndrome is a far second to the damage the vaccines have caused the kids' brains. But anyways, officially, it's the most common cause of non-hereditary mental retardation. And my study was met with crickets, absolute crickets.
When they don't want to change their paradigm, they just ignore it.
Yeah, no. And the paradigm is if it's not making the pharmaceutical company money, you don't hear about it. End of story.
Yeah.
And pharmaceutical companies will sell things to you they know don't work. So I think I put it in my book about the drug that they use for women with irritable bladders. They know they have a customer for life because women with irritable bladders usually have an anaerobic urinary tract infection and have to be treated for that anaerobic. Why do I say anaerobic? Because if you go and have your urine culture, nothing will grow. Because it requires an environment free of oxygen to grow these plates. And no one does that. That's only done in a research environment now. I talk about how the pharmaceutical company knows what the real reason is. But here they have a product they can sell that relieves some of the symptoms and they know it won't cure you. So you're a customer for life. Even though they could easily tell you, you might want to get checked for an anaerobic urinary tract infection. They're not going to tell you that. That interferes with their business.
Yeah. So much monkey business with the pharmaceutical industry. If I ever watch TV, you just see this endless list of pharmaceutical ads, and I just like get
it. It's like the commercials they have for the immunosuppressants for treating Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis. Make sure you ask your doctor. You don't have tuberculosis. You know why they say that? Because the driving infection and inflammatory bowel disease is an infection. The driving infection is a mycobacterium, just like tuberculosis. But it's not the tuberculosis mycobacterium. It's a more robust version called Mycobacterium avium paratuberculosis. And it's ubiquitous. It's everywhere in the environment. But if you're susceptible, it lands and makes home in your intestines, you'll have inflammatory bowel disease. But so much money is being made on these immunosuppressants, which is the absolute wrong thing to give. 180-degree wrong thing. If you have an infection, you don't want to turn off your immune system. You want to enhance your immune system.
Yeah.
It's just very sad because this information is out there, okay? The information that ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease is caused by MAP, Mycobacterium avian paratuberculosis, is out there. And the treatments are out there. All the treatments are generic.
The pharmaceutical company,
they're not going to make any money on the drugs because basically you're on a regimen, the same regimen you would be on for treating tuberculosis.
Yeah. So in your book, Incurable Me, you tackle a bunch of very important issues that are not widely understood or even known by most of our population. I'm just curious about the timing. I think I heard that you lost your license.
Correct.
And when did that happen? And did it have anything to do with your book?
I think I was targeted. Now, in 2017, I wrote a blog for the Bolin Report where I spelled out exactly what was going to end up happening in 2020. I didn't know exactly what the organism was going to be. I said, it needs to be an organism we have a vaccine for because they're going to blame the unvaccinated. In my blog, I just picked mumps as an example, but I said it could be an Ebola-like event. These people love drama. I know I got on radar, and of course, my book came out in 2016. And the interesting thing about my book, because medical books, if they're older than 5 years old, they're completely outdated. There's virtually nothing outdated in my book.
Yeah, I just read it yesterday and today, and you're right. It was like almost foretelling the future.
Yes, and in the conclusion, I hint at what's coming. And then in 2017, I wrote that blog where I specifically said what's coming. And then I wrote a paper called Gain of Function, Loss of Sanity, Pandemics and the Descent into Medical Madness. And if I didn't have a target on my back already, so in California, they had that bill called SB 277, which eliminated informed consent completely. And the only way you could get a medical exemption, get out of taking vaccines is with a medical exemption. So no personal religious waivers or anything like that. But what the legislators did, because they wouldn't have been able to pass the bill without it, they greatly expanded the reasons you could offer a medical exemption. For example, family history. And because before this bill, you had to follow CDC contraindications. And the list of CDC contraindications are not only not comprehensive, but they're not meant for writing medical exemptions.
And that's so restrictive that basically you can't get an adequate medical exemption anywhere.
Right. I mean, you either have a progressive neurological disease or an immunodeficiency, and that's it. So if you don't have one of those two things, you're not in line with CDC contraindications. I went to the medical board and I said, hey, I have questions about this new law. Can you help me clarify those questions?
You went right to the belly of the beast.
And they said, no, we don't do that. End of story. So I hired a lawyer, Greg Glazer, and because I said I want to make sure I have a lawyer's advice when I'm creating my protocol for giving medical exemptions. And you're not supposed to lose your license if you, there's a new law and you sought legal advice on how to implement the law. This was, I think, an effort. The Federation for State Medical Boards has always had it in for alternative medical practitioners. Anything they could do to get rid of them, they have tried to do. So this was a way of basically trapping physicians who didn't completely buy the whole vaccine scam and trapping them and eliminating them. And they didn't care about the law. They didn't care about the facts. They just got rid of or punished as many physicians as they could.
Yeah. That's interesting you put it that way, because that's what I thought it was. You guys were given this expanded medical exemption, encouraged in a way. They knew people would then take advantage of that to support their patients. And so you're doing what's right for your patient, and then you're trapped. They come after, and I don't know how many physicians in California have lost their licenses or are suffering greatly under a lot of stipulations.
Yeah, I remember saying at my hearing, shame on anyone who would give a four-month-old in congestive heart failure vaccines. So these were the medical exemptions I gave out were very legitimate. They just didn't follow CDC contraindications. But they didn't care that this was, like I said, the fix was in. And the Fair Hearing Bureau, which is not fair at all, sees their job as supporting whatever the position is of the medical board.
Yep. Yep.
So
how have you pivoted? What are you doing now?
I'm in the appeal process in New Mexico for my license there, because once you lose your license in one state, they start attacking you in every other state you had a license. And I basically doing hyperbaric oxygen therapy with a family that I saved their lives 10 years ago, and they installed their own facility, and they're having me run it for them. Now, interesting, you don't need a license to operate a hyperbaric chamber. So.
Interesting. So you can just cure more and more people, or at least greatly help them.
And it's interesting that during COVID, we tried to get chambers to the Navajo, the Dene people, and we were just violently rejected. And I couldn't figure out why. And it was because these organizations were getting paid a lot of money to just do the government protocol, which was wait until you're half dead, put you on Versed, Remdesivir, and stick a tube down your throat. That they were getting paid to only do that.
Yep.
So they were not interested in any kind of other therapies because they weren't getting paid to do those therapies. So when I actually came down with COVID, which was a surprise because I had SARS-1 19 years ago or 20 years ago and was hoping I had antibodies. But when I got COVID, I immediately started the full court press with everything, hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, zinc, vitamin D, you name it. And I had a very truncated course, but 2 days into it, without any respiratory symptoms, I could see my oxygen saturations crashing.
Mm.
If I hyperventilated, I could get it into the low 90s. So you can't go around hyperventilating, and you certainly can't hyperventilate and go to sleep at the same time. I realized that this virus was interfering with mitochondrial function, that it was basically poisoning the oxygen transport system.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, wait until I tell Pierre Corey about this. I go, no wonder hyperbaric oxygen works on these patients, but hyperbaric oxygen's going to have to wait until the dying paradigm we're in falls apart, which will be happening soon. It'll happen with the financial collapse that's coming.
Yeah.
And then medicine the aftermath of this financial collapse that's coming might eliminate all third-party payers, many of these NGOs and institutes, because there's just not going to be money. And everyone's doing all these nasty things because they have money. They're getting money. So if patients have to use their own money or their own chickens or whatever they're using to pay for services, they're going to gravitate to the therapies they know are most efficient and efficacious. And I think it's going to be after the collapse that things like hyperbaric oxygen therapy will come to the fore and will become standard practice for treating traumatic brain injuries and kids with cerebral palsy and fetal alcohol syndrome, things like that.
Yeah. You'll be well positioned to help a lot of us when that time comes. As we wrap it up, Ken, this has been so fun for me because I've followed a similar journey as you have. We don't have time to get into it. It'll have to be a second interview. But your book, Incurable Me, you cover some really big stuff with some very, that one there. Yep. It is just, you cover Alzheimer's, schizophrenia, autism, Lyme disease, all the pesticides, DDT. You've got a great end of chapter 2 with detox supplements. Just boom. That's about everything I would recommend. It's right there. Aluminum, vaccine, geoengineering. We could have a whole show on that probably. We touched on the IBS. You've got the traumatic brain injury you've covered, vaccines, autoimmunity, the whole quote religion of jabism. I love that chapter. I want you to have the closing words. We've got an audience that consists of a lot of people who are aware of some of what we're talking about. And then hopefully we're reaching other people who are just starting to go, what's going on? What would be your message in closing for everybody?
Well, I think do your own research. Be prepared. Have the things that you, as you're doing your research, have the things you think you might need for treating yourself in your home already. For example, if you come down with COVID, that's not the time to go looking for ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine and quercetin. And you want to have them on your shelf. And I think that in general, because we're going to be going through a rough patch, people need to be as optimistic and positive and envision what they want the world to look like, how they want the world to function after we get rid of the WEF, New World Order group people and all their plots. Our unlovely society, as we're finding out, it is quite unlovely. The organ trafficking, the sex trafficking, our country being flooded with drugs as part of a fifth column war against us. These things are going to pass, and people need to start thinking about, how do I want to be operating in this new world? How do I want this world to operate? Because the sun will come out eventually here, and we need to help create this new society.
Thank you for ending on that note of hope. And then just for fun, viewers, don't sign off just yet. Dee Dee's going to come and just get a little personal with our Dr. Ken Stoller, so you get to know him, the man, just a little bit more. Thank you so much. We could do another show for sure. Appreciate you.
Hi, Dr. Stoller. Thank you for being willing to talk to me. So you and I have something in common. I was injured, different vaccine, but I was injured as a five-year-old. I ended up having open heart surgery within 48 hours of receiving a smallpox shot. And again, when I heard you talking to Doc, you don't even know really at that age what's happened to you or what's going on. So I love that for you, it ended up being something that moving forward and doing pediatrics, you're able to help people. So thank you for that. I like what you said at the end that the sun will come out. Where do you get your faith? How do you have faith over fear? With everything that you've seen, you still believe this is all going to be great like I do? So what's that for you?
Because these plots, the tyrannies, they're always fairly short-lived. Now, they may last longer than we want, but they always come to an end, because this is a planet where the primary operating system is duality.
Mm-hmm.
So when things go to one extreme too far, something always happens to bring balance.
Right.
So that's how things operate here on planet Earth. And I guess what I'm asking people is, yes, you have to exist in duality, but you don't have to be a participant. Underneath duality is a more kinder, comprehensive energy field called the unified field.
Right.
And you can exist in that. You don't have to exist in this, the crazy duality system that we're in, where things keep swinging from one extreme to another, going back to balance,
right,
et cetera, et cetera. And I talk about this in my book, that we're actually working with the Atlantean archetype of, and whether or not you believe there was an Atlantis or not is irrelevant. The Atlantean archetype is having everything and then losing everything.
Right.
And that is what we are now about to experience.
And so, I like that you said that. And that's what I meant when I talk about faith over fear. Everybody has something different maybe that they believe in. What would you do if you could go back 40 years, 50 years, education? What would you do differently knowing what you know now?
When I was 16 and I was working at NASA's Biosatellite 3 project, the resident physician knew I wanted to be a physician, and he did everything in his power to try to talk me out of going into medicine. And he told me all the nightmares that I could expect to see in the future as a physician. He completely underestimated how bad things
actually
got. Okay.
It turned out to be worse.
Far worse. And basically, physicians have been steered into institutionalized medicine. 85% of physicians work for an institution. And so you practice institutionalized medicine. And they want all the physicians to be under their thumb, under their control. That's why the solo practitioners, the independent entrepreneurial physicians get picked on. Because you're actually slowing up the conversion of having physicians become obedient members of the medical cartel.
Right.
And as most people know, the medical cartel are the foot soldiers of the globalists. Because amazing things can be done to people. Amazing, nasty things under the guise of public health measures. It's for your safety. It's
right.
For your health. Okay. And they know this. And so that's why medicine had to be captured. And it was. And it was captured.
So except would you do it differently? Well, would you change if you now knowing that?
First of all, I can't go back 40 years.
You can in your mind.
In my mind. Obviously, if I knew then what I know now, no, I would not be going into medicine.
Okay. So know what you would have done?
Park ranger.
What park would you have picked? What park?
Yellowstone.
I would have came and visited you. That's so awesome.
No, I actually wanted to be a musician.
Oh, really? What instrument?
My mom did not want me to become a musician. So if I got too good on any one instrument, she encouraged me to switch instruments.
Now that's a clever mom. That's a good way to get what you want your son to do.
And the weirder the instrument, the better. So she basically was very supportive of me learning non-commercially viable instruments.
Did you ever play the dulcimer?
No, but it was the bagpipes that basically I landed on.
So awesome. Okay, so musician maybe, park ranger. So say you decide even 40 years ago, you go into medicine. Would you, again, knowing what you know now, would you have, that's cool. Is that a didgeridoo, whatever it's called?
This is a Native American flute.
Oh, okay.
I have different flutes from different countries, from Armenia, from Turkey, I'm learning to play the Cajun accordion and the flugelhorn. And
you're a musician now.
My mom would not be supportive of the flugelhorn because that is potentially commercially viable.
Okay. That is so, so awesome.
When I outgrew my first piano teacher and she took me around to interviewing other piano teachers, there was one guy and he was in Beverly Hills and he says, oh, I'll have him doing this and this in no time. And we never saw him again. And later on, I said, remember that guy who said he was going to have me doing this and this in no time? How come we didn't use him as my piano teacher? She said, because I believed him.
Oh my God. Yeah. She didn't want you to be a musician. So if you went into medicine, again, going back 40 years or you're starting knowing what you know, would you have picked pediatrics or do you think you would have gone a different route, more integrative or something different right from the start, knowing what you know?
I like psychiatry, but my feeling was I could deal with having to see crazy, quote unquote, patients every day. I couldn't deal with the fact that my colleagues were also crazy.
Awesome.
I already talked about OBGYN, how they weren't teaching residents how to help women in difficult labor. They were just teaching them how to do C-sections.
Right.
And I didn't want to be part of that. And it also was my feeling that 9 out of every 10 obstetricians were misogynists. And it didn't matter whether they were men or women. They were still misogynists. Now, the 1 out of 10 OBGYNs that were not misogynists, I worshiped the ground they walked on. But I decided it wasn't the specialty for me. It was not the specialty for me. Okay. And I could have easily got in that program. I was called the Michelangelo of episiotomies. So it was eliminating one specialty after another. And finally, the only one left was pediatrics. And there seemed to be good reason for going into it because your patients try to work with you to stay, to be healthy. They have good immune systems and who knew what we were about to walk into with all these vaccines? Because during my residency, I was still in the early 1980s, where we had, 6 vaccines we were giving? That's it?
I know, and that's the thing. So I have to wrap up my interview with you. Dr. Paul took too long. So my last kind of fun question for you is, what do you say to other doctors, especially now, new medical students and doctors that are people that are going to be your students that are going to choose pediatrics? What do you say to them? Because like you and Dr. Paul talk about, that indoctrination is so powerful and everything you learn. But if you could sit down with 12 medical students that are going to go into pediatrics, what would you say to them?
A lot of people go into medicine because it seems like it's a low risk way of having a career. You do X, Y, and Z, and boom, you have a medical license and you can get a job.
Right.
So these people are risk averse, right? And they're selected for being good memorizers, but not particularly good critical thinkers.
Right.
And I would tell somebody that I would never discourage anyone who really wanted to go into medicine from going into medicine, but I would tell them what the state of medicine is at the moment. And unless you want to be a reformer, do not go into it.
Right.
And if you do want to be a reformer, you have to be willing to, pay the price.
So if somebody wants to help people, which I believe that's why people go into medicine, is they want to help nursing, any of that. If somebody is a bright student, they are critical thinkers and they want, would you say rather than getting a medical degree, would you say naturopathics or chiropractor, would you say that there's another route that's better than medicine to help people?
Well, I will tell you what was told to me by a mystic when I was in my early 20s.
Okay.
They said, by the time I'm 40 years old, which would be 20 years in the future, many other physicians would be thinking the way I thought. I would not be alone anymore. But what I was not told was those physicians would not be MDs.
Okay.
That's when your naturopaths and your chiropractors and your acupuncturists, those were the physicians who started to think the way I thought.
Okay. That's amazing. So thank you for taking time with me. I'm sure we're going to get to see you again at some point. I plan on heading out to your cabin in Montana or to Yellowstone. I don't think it's too late. I think you can still be a park ranger.
I don't know about that.
Okay, I think you can. I'll look up the application process for you. Thank you for your time, Dr. Stoller.
I look forward to running together with the wind at our backs, revealing the science that gives clarity in our world that's full of propaganda and misinformation. Visit our website, doctorsinscience.com. Sign up. Donate if you can. Your support makes a difference. And let's make this the weekly show the world has been waiting for. Thanks for watching. I'm Dr. Paul.